Our topic this afternoon, the major prophets versus premillennialism. And that little word versus is really a key to the term, because in not a single one of these prophets or their prophetic works do we find word one or syllable one in support of premillennialism. And of course, that could not be the case if there were any sympathy at all among these four for premillennialism, because premillennialism being a system of infidelic error, and these four great major prophets being prophets of truth and nothing but truth, we would naturally expect there would not be as much as an iota of affinity among these four with one of the prominent doctrines of our day. Premillennialism is certainly not as old as the Old Testament. It came much later. And it's not even as old as the New Testament. It came later. Now, it is true that some of the church fathers, sometimes called the patristic fathers, did hold some of these tendencies, and that's what we usually designate as old historic premillennialism. But really, their system waned in popularity, and it was in the 1800s, and especially by a man by the name of John Darby, that premillennialism had a rebirth, a revival. We wish that the entire system had stayed buried, and buried permanently. But this man helped to revive this system. And I guess out of all the many, many people who have advocated it during the 1800s and the 1900s, he would be the modern-day father of what we sometimes call dispensational premillennialism. Of course, they divide history and the future into seven periods of time, and that's the significance of dispensational premillennialism. There was a Bible put out of sorts a number of years ago by a man whose name was Scofield. And in that Bible, he had a number of notes, footnotes, fatal in nature, in which he suggested the primary doctrines of premillennialism, and especially dispensational premillennialism. I was in a gospel meeting a while back and spoke by request on some of the dangers that we face from modern versions of the Bible. And there was a couple that made mention as they were leaving one night and said, "We have recently purchased a new Bible for one of our children, and we'd like to know your assessment of it." I said, "What did you purchase?" And they said, "We purchased a Scofield's Reference Bible." I said, "Surely you did not." They said, "We did." Well, that's just about the equal of what our Lord referred to by giving children stones instead of that which is worthwhile. And they had given their child something that would be poisonous to his system if he accepted the footnotes that are to be found in that so-called Bible. I guess more than any one other volume, this has done more, especially in the 20th century, to acquaint people and to help people swallow this doctrine of premillennialism, especially dispensational premillennialism. Of course, this is a system of infidelity. I do not have any hesitation in labeling it as such. I believe that it calls for an entire rewriting of the entire Bible, not just the New Testament, but the Old Testament as well. In fact, they have to begin rewriting it in the very first of the Bible as they begin to tamper with the Abrahamic promises in Genesis, the 12th chapter. And they just continue the rewriting of it throughout the Old Testament as well as the New Testament as well. Paul makes mention in 2 Corinthians 4:2, "But have renounced the hidden things of dishonesty," and especially he mentions not handling the Word of God deceitfully. And if there's any group of people on earth who handles the Word of God deceitfully, it would be the entire camp of premillennialism. We're warned by the Apostle Peter not to torture and to twist the Scriptures, but they believe in torturing and twisting the Scriptures. We are warned by the Apostle Paul in Galatians 1:6-10 that we're not to pervert the gospel, and yet they pervert it coming and going. And unfortunately, and yet I'm not surprised at this, a number of the new Bibles that have come out during this century have done a little bit more to promote the entire movement than Scofield did. At least Scofield put it in notes. He had it pretty close to the biblical text, but they've just incorporated it into the very text of the Bible. That's what they've done with a number of major errors. They've taken what used to be found in confessionals of faith and disciplines and catechisms and the like, and they've just moved this into the very text, or at least what they call the text of the Bible. And any number of the new Bibles are premillennial and slant, some of them more so than others. I want to give just a little bit of a review of what we mean by premillennialism. But let me preface my remarks by saying that we have three senses in the world. I'm not talking about the five well-known senses of smell and taste and feeling and so forth. I'm talking about the three senses of inspired sense and common sense and nonsense. Inspired sense, of course, would be the Bible. Common sense would be that with which we have been blessed by a gracious Creator in order to help us go through life, meeting the challenges of this world, and especially coming to a knowledge of what we are taught in the Holy Book of the Bible. And then we have nonsense. May I suggest to you that premillennialism does not belong and is not derived from inspired sense, not biblical in any sense at all. And it certainly does not belong in the second category of being common sense. It belongs in that third category of being nonsense. And why so many people have become enamored with it, why religious leaders have begun to peddle it, is more than I can understand. But there have been a number of religious leaders in this country, in this century, that have peddled it in their writings, in their public speeches, and the like. John R. Rice, formerly of Murfreesboro, Tennessee, before his death, he was an avid premillennialist. He was really gung-ho on the rapture. He thought the rapture would be something like the honeymoon of Christians. Well, where Mr. Ross is now, he knows better than what he taught during the course of his life. Another man that has done so much in promoting it would be Hal Lindsey. He began to write best-selling books a few years back, and the very royalties that have come from these books have made him a multi-millionaire. He has written in regard to fancy and fictional material. In fact, he would put many of the writers that deal with fictional material in the shade. But it just seems to be the case that with the writings of Hal Lindsey, real facts have a hard way of getting into his works. That's just not his cup of tea. Billy Graham has become an avowed premillennialist in recent years. Maybe he held these views all along, but it seems to me that I've heard him teach them more in recent years than he did when I first began to listen to him and read after him in the 1940s and the 1950s. I hear some of my brethren say that about the only difference they have with Mr. Graham is when he gets to the gospel plan of salvation. Well, he tempers with that, no doubt about that, but he also is a thoroughgoing premillennialist. And there have been other writers that have helped to publicize it and popularize it for our day. Basically, it's a system that says that the Old Testament prophets, inclusive of men like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Daniel, as well as other Hebrew prophets of the Old Testament, actually prophesied of a coming kingdom. And they would contend that that's the purpose that brought Jesus from the palace of the universe to this earth of ours in order to fulfill that plan, that is, of establishing the kingdom of the Lord upon the earth. But they claim that the Godhead was caught off guard, that it evidently did not occur to God the Father and Christ the Son that they would run into so much obstinacy and stubbornness among the Jewish people. And that when the Jewish people basically said, we're not going to have anything to do with that kind of spiritual kingdom that the Messiah has begun to preach about in parable and his other teachings, they say that the Godhead hastily met, decided to table indefinitely any plans for the establishment of the kingdom. In fact, it's not at all unusual to hear and read them say of how the prophetic clock came to a stop, and there hasn't been a tick-tock in that prophetic clock from that day until now. They claim that the Godhead hastily worked out a substitutionary device, namely the church, and that's the reason that we are in the church age now, and that the kingdom period is yet to come. A question that we as gospel preachers have been asking them for years, if the Jewish people in their objections actually thwarted the plan of deity the first time the Lord came, what's going to keep the Jewish people from being just as stubborn the next time He comes? And if they decide they don't want anything to do with the kingdom that He's going to come according to premillennial contentions, then will the Godhead have to assemble and work out another substitutionary device and again table indefinitely the plan to establish the kingdom? But they contend that the kingdom is not here and will not be here until the second coming of our Lord. Well, of course, if the kingdom is not here, then we don't have the new birth, because the new birth, according to John 3:5, puts people into the kingdom. I get rather amused in hearing some of these fellows talk about the need to be born again, and yet they are premillennialists. I would like to be in position to raise a hand and ask one question. What are you going to have them enter when they are born again? There isn't any kingdom according to you. You've just spent your lesson today in denying that the kingdom is here. And if there is no kingdom, then we don't have any new birth. And if we don't have any new birth, then obviously there is no pardon for all. I knew a lady in West Tennessee a number of years ago, and she really, really got upset with me. Of course, she wasn't the first one that's ever done that, nor has she been the last one. But she said, I feel like you are just entirely too hard on premillennialism. I don't believe it's all that injurious or all that dangerous. In fact, I think it's a harmless doctrine. She'd been in the church at that time longer than I had lived. And amazingly, she belonged to a congregation that had been plagued by a preacher that they had had to get rid of because of his premillennialism. She had seen the fruit of it firsthand, and yet still contended that it was just a harmless doctrine. Well, I can think of any number of adjectives that ought to be placed before premillennialism, but harmless is not one of those accurate adjectives to be placed before it. They claim that Jesus Christ is not now on David's throne. They claim that there will be a long interval between the resurrection of the righteous and the resurrection of the wicked. They used to say 1,000 years, but now they've had to do a little bit of addition because the dispensational brand of this system of infidelity calls for another 7 years. Inclusive of the rapture and the great tribulation and the battle of Armageddon and all of the other things that they have put in to the years right before Jesus begins his so-called reign upon the earth. Now they have about 1,007-year interval between the resurrection of the righteous and the resurrection of the wicked. And yet Jesus declares in John 5:28-29, that the hour is coming in which all that are in the grave shall hear His voice and come forth. They that have done good unto the resurrection of life, they that have done evil unto the resurrection of damnation. It's amazing how much they can stretch that little word hour out to 1,007 years, and then you put that down in weeks and months and days and hours, and it's amazing what they have done with that little word hour. I've often said in speaking about premillennialism that if the Congress of the United States could stretch our tax dollars the way that they can stretch that hour in John 5, we would no longer be running in the red and carrying on the government year by year as we are. But nevertheless, they contend for a long interval of time. They claim, of course, that God has a special place for the Jew. In fact, they are fond of talking about the Jewish people as God's special people. They still attach some kind of significance to the land that lies at the eastern edge of the Mediterranean Sea. To them, it is still a holy land, and the Jewish people are still God's special people. It apparently does not matter to these premillennial people that most every Jew on earth, with but few exceptions, hates Jesus Christ with a passion. Many of them feel just like Harry Orlinsky did, one of the translators of the Revised Standard Version, when he lectured out on the West Coast back in 1978, who went on record as suggesting that the Holy Bible ought to end with Malachi 4:6, that the New Testament, the Greek New Testament, is neither part nor parcel of God's revelation. And he did not hesitate in the least in suggesting that Jesus was born illegitimately, that Mary had an affair with some other man, and that Jesus Christ was not virgin-born in any sense of the term. He was speaking as a Jew in those statements. It's always amazed me why the RSV people, as modernistic as that thing is, agreed to have somebody of that disposition help them with a translation of the Old Testament. But they have a special place for the Jew. They believe that in the premillennial period, and they are especially fond of going to some statements in Isaiah the 11th chapter, and then a statement or two found in the book of Ezekiel, that during the premillennial or the millennial period, when Christ rules upon the earth, that this earth is going to enjoy a totally different kind of situation. That there will be a completely overhaul in animal husbandry, that animals will no longer be vicious, no longer will they be dangerous for even a little child to play in their midst, that domestic animals will be able to be with these wild, voracious animals that we have known. And each time I take my grandchildren to the zoo up here at Memphis, I'm always glad that we're separated by a few feet from the roaring lion or the bears that stalk up and down. I certainly do not believe the day is ever going to come when there will be an overhaul of these here upon the earth. But these are some of the fundamentals that they stress in their premillennial contentions. And it's my conviction that Isaiah refutes that thing, that Jeremiah refutes that thing, that Ezekiel refutes that thing, and that Daniel refutes that system of infidelity. Looking at Isaiah and how his book is an excellent refutation of premillennialism. Now really one of their sugar stick passages in Isaiah is in the second chapter, wherein Isaiah pictured that the days will come, the last days, in which the mountain of the Lord's house will be established above the hills, exalted above the mountains and hills. All nations will flow unto it. Many people will go and say, come ye, let us go up to the house of the Lord. He'll teach us of his ways. We'll walk in his paths. And the law of the Lord will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And they especially like that next verse that talks about the changing of military implements into agricultural implements. They think that talks about a time out there in the future when there is not going to be any kind of war here upon the earth. In fact, when Kenneth Taylor, and I've wished for a long, long time that he had a different last name or had not decided to do so much tampering with God's holy word, but when he put out his Living Bible paraphrased about 20 or 25 years ago, he, of course, was a thoroughgoing premillennialist, just as he was a thoroughgoing Calvinist. And, of course, he put a lot of his premillennialism and Calvinism in the product that he turned out. Incidentally, Billy Graham did more than any other one person on earth to promote that thing and bought an enormous amount of it in order to pass out in his crusade work. I think that says a lot about Graham and the superficial knowledge that he has of basic New Testament Christianity. Imagine passing out a book that is so detrimental and destructive to the very basics of New Testament Christianity. But when Taylor came to Isaiah, the second chapter, he especially has Jerusalem as being the ruling center of the universe. He has Jesus Christ reigning in the city of Jerusalem. He has all wars to cease. All military training will come to an end. And there will be unlimited and unparalleled prosperity and peace upon the earth. I don't guess Hal Lindsey ever wrote anything more in the way of premillennial upbeat and support than what Taylor put in what he called Living Bible Paraphrase. Well, this is just simply a prophecy about the coming of the kingdom or the establishment of the church. It does not find its fulfillment out there in some millennial tomorrow. It began to be fulfilled in Acts, the second chapter, when the church had its beautiful beginning upon the earth, when the gospel was preached, when the word of the Lord was made known. And incidentally, Isaiah, 7 to 7.5 centuries before the birth of Christianity, viewed Christianity as being a law. And we have brethren today who live almost 2,000 years beyond the establishment of the church. And they still haven't learned and accepted that there is law in Christianity. But the law of the Lord was going to go forth from Zion and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And the idea of those people changing their military implements and weaponry into agricultural implements is to be seen as a highly figurative passage suggestive that those who accept the teachings of the Prince of Peace, though they may have been warlike in times gone by, slaughtered each other, they learned the ways of peace. I don't believe that passage is talking about what unregenerate men and women will do as they'll continue to war and feud and fuss and fight until the very end of time. In fact, when Jesus gave the parable of the tares, he suggested that the tares and the wheat are going to last until the time of the harvest. And the time of the harvest is the end of the world, meaning that there is not going to be a 1,000-year period in which there will be no evil upon the earth. Good and evil are going to continue right down to the very end of time. Unless that be the case, it's difficult to understand what the Lord meant when he asked the question, when the Son of Man cometh, will he find faith upon the earth? He knew that there would be infidelity up till his second coming. And I know they'll make a dodge on that and say, well, he's just simply talking about his coming for the rapture and coming for the beginning of the millennial reign. But Jesus is talking about his second coming and the end of the world. They especially like to go to Isaiah, the 11th chapter, especially dealing with animals. I made mention of this a little bit earlier. They will mention such wild, ferocious animals as the lion and the wolf and the leopard and poisonous vipers. And then they'll have the lamb and the kid and the cow and the calves and so forth as they mix and mingle without any difficulty. And as a little child is able to play in the midst of these, even putting hands upon these former poisonous vipers without any injury, without any damage at all. Well, I'd like to emphasize that this is a highly figurative passage suggestive that when people obey the gospel and come under the sweet influence of Jesus Christ, it will change their lives. If they've been wild people, restless people, if they've been violent people, it will change them into people of peace and the people that will promote goodwill in the human family. In fact, the gospel was never designed to change animals in the jungle. It has been designed and continues to be designed to change the jungle that is in men. And there's a vast difference between the two. They are especially fond of going to a passage over in the latter part of Isaiah that makes mention of the sheer mercies of David, and they claim that that will find its fulfillment in that millennial tomorrow. But Paul, when he went to Antioch of Pisidia in Acts the 13th chapter, and Luke recorded that sermon for us, Paul has his eye riveted upon this passage in Isaiah. And he says that it finds fulfillment in Christianity. The sheer mercies of David were available to these Pisidian people right there that time. The writer Isaiah was not talking about some future out there in a so-called millennial period. He's talking about the sheer mercies of David, the spiritual blessings that will come under Christianity. Of course, there are other passages in the book of Isaiah that they really, really like to latch on to. But I want to say a little something about Jeremiah. Jeremiah lived several years after Isaiah did. And Jeremiah was an eyewitness to much of the tragedy that led up to the dissolving of the nation of Judah. He had been a faithful prophet of God under Josiah. At least during those early years, he had some support from the crown. But with the death of Josiah, Josiah was followed in office by three of his sons and one of his grandsons, and the four men that followed him were as wicked as Josiah was righteous. And during those years, Jeremiah did not have any help, no support at all from the men who wore the crown, who sat upon the throne of David. But Jeremiah predicted to these people that you are going to be taken into captivity. Now, he offered them a solution in the early part of his prophetic ministry, but they would have no part of it. Finally, the time came when Jeremiah said, "You're going to go into captivity. The Babylonian king is going to come against you. And even if the Babylonian army were composed of blind men and men very weak, they'd still take this city when they come against it." But he held out hope to these people. He suggested that the captivity is going to last for 70 years. False prophets like Hananiah taught that it would only be 2 years. Well, he didn't miss it much more than the premillennial people did. He just missed it by 68 years, and they missed their marks a lot more than that. But the duration was to be 70 years. And Jeremiah knew that there was going to be a coming back. And that return was not to be way out there in the future. It was to be fulfilled at the end of the 70-year period. That's what he predicted, and Daniel, knowing that that time was near at hand, he began to lift his voice in prayer for these people. In the latter part of 2 Chronicles 36, the opening part of Ezra the first chapter, and interestingly enough, the last part of 2 Chronicles 36 reads the same as the opening verses of Ezra 1. The only time in the Bible where concluding verses of one book read just like opening verses of the book that follows it in our arrangement. I've always thought that was rather interesting. But anyway, in these verses, Cyrus the Persian king made mention of the fact that God had given him a commission to allow the Israelite people to go back and rebuild Jerusalem, reestablish again the temple. And this humane ruler, much more humane than Nebuchadnezzar and some of the other Chaldean conquerors had been, allowed these people to go back. And they did return to their land. They did finally get around to rebuilding and finishing the temple, especially when Haggai and Zechariah began to encourage them to do so. They rebuilt their city. They rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem. And the prophecies among the Hebrew prophets of the Old Testament talking about a return were fulfilled under Zerubbabel and Joshua and allowed by Cyrus the Persian monarch. And these fellows that feel like these prophecies are to be fulfilled way out there in the future, they are way off base. Jeremiah, in Jeremiah the 31st chapter, makes mention that the Lord was going to establish a new covenant. Not like the covenant that he had given to their fathers when he took them by the hand of Egypt, or by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant break, though I was a husband unto them. And then he gives the basics of this new covenant. And that new covenant, as we all recognize, went into effect on the day of Pentecost. and that new covenant and the establishment of the kingdom are wrapped up in the same spiritual package. We don't have the beginning of the Christian covenant at one period, and then way out there in the future, the establishment of the kingdom way down the line. Just as the new covenant began there on the day of Pentecost, that's when the church or the kingdom had its beginning. But there is a little passage, five words in length, that the premillennial people really have a heyday with, as they refer to the time of Jacob's trouble. Four or five words, and it's amazing how much of a doctrine they can build on this short expression. I live up in Lauderdale County in West Tennessee, and our county is filled and running over with premillennial people. In fact, we have a Baptist church out on Highway 51, the four-lane Highway 51, that has out on their sign that they are premillennial. I have a radio program each Sunday morning, and then a little bit later on, there is one of the Baptist preachers in Ripley that has a short program, and about two out of every three programs that he presents, he will talk about premillennialism. I heard him recently as he talked about the time of Jacob's trouble. And just as any premillennialist will do, he claims that it finds fulfillment in that tribulation period, when in reality, Jeremiah is talking about the trouble that Jacob experienced in the captivity, and ultimately, of course, would end with their coming back to the land. Talk about missing a text. They really, really do with that passage. But Jeremiah is no friend and no supporter to premillennialism at all. Now, a little something about Ezekiel. Ezekiel was one of the ones taken into captivity. Daniel and the three Hebrew children, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, were taken into captivity about 605, some say 606 B.C. And then about 9 years later, there were about 10,000 others taken into captivity. This is the second deportation. And Ezekiel is in that second deportation. And then about 11 years later, the city fell to Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian army, at which time the city was destroyed, the palaces and the houses were burned, the temple was leveled, and many, many people were taken into captivity. A remnant was left. Jeremiah chose to stay with the remnant, and later on was forced to go with some of the rebels into the land of Egypt. But in regard to Ezekiel, he, of course, is no friend and no supporter of premillennial doctrine. He began to prophesy about 5 years after he was taken into captivity, about 592 B.C., and in all probability prophesied for about 22 years, maybe down to about 570 B.C. We're not sure exactly how long he may have lived after that. I don't think it's very likely, since he apparently was about 30 years old at the time that he began to prophesy, that he would have lived to see the end of the captivity. Anyway, his prophetic career did not last nearly that long. But he gave hope to the people in Chaldean bondage. He was the star figure of the exile, as he has been called. He gave them words of encouragement and told them that they were going to be able to return to their homeland. And of course, he's not talking about some kind of return to Palestine mandated by the UN in 1948 and the years thereafter. He's talking about the return at the end of the 70-year period. And there is much in the way of encouragement that he gives to these people about their return to the land of their nativity. He especially has some graphic and vivid lessons in Ezekiel, the 37th chapter, as he talks about the opening of the graves and the coming together of the bones. And this is a beautiful picture of the fact that they were going to be released from their bondage, that they were going to come back. He makes mention of the two sticks that are joined. One stick has Judah's name on it, the other has Israel's name on it, and as they were joined together, that signified that the nation, the two former nations, would now become a united nation again. The premillennial people really have a heyday with Ezekiel 38 and 39, as they feel like this is a reference to the future. In fact, there was a man by the name of Harry Rimmer a number of years ago who wrote a little work dealing with some of these matters, and he claimed that out there in the future there's going to be a great fight between the Jewish people and the Russian people, and that the Jewish people will have such skill that they will have military instruments that will destroy planes and tanks and the like. And I've been wondering why, if Rimmer's right, why they hadn't used that to destroy the weaponry of their Arab nations in the years. But nevertheless, Rimmer went on to spin out his theory that the Jewish people will act, or rather, there will be a system worked out where the enemies will actually have weapons made out of wood. And of course, Ezekiel 38 and 39 talks about their old ancient weapons. I want to mention one other thing from this same line of thought. In the latter part of Isaiah, the 66th chapter, we have people mentioned as coming from all parts of the world and riding upon mules and swift beasts and chariots and the like, coming to Jerusalem to make their offerings. And they'll do it at the new moons, and they'll do it on the Sabbath days. And of course, the premillennial people think that that ought to be literally understood. Well, it seems to me that that will present quite a problem. People having to come from all parts of the world every month, and people having to come every week to Jerusalem. And the premillennial people, well, they say they surely can come by means of planes. But remember, they have a literalization that they set forth. And these people have to come to Jerusalem on mules and by chariots and horses and the like. And, of course, they claim that we're on the very threshold of these matters right today. There are 5 billion of us. It appears to me that if everybody has to come to Jerusalem every month and every Sabbath day, that the old city of Jerusalem is going to be rather crowded. And especially when you get all the mules and the horses and all of the people from all of the world assembling regularly there. But that shows the ridiculousness of it. Daniel, of course, refuted the system. In Daniel, the second chapter, he talked about the Babylonian Empire, followed by the Medo-Persian Empire, followed by the Grecian Empire, followed by the Roman Empire. And it was to be in the days of the Roman kings when the God of heaven would set up a kingdom which should never be destroyed. Well, since they claim that it wasn't established in the days of the Roman Caesars, then they've had to work out a system where Rome, in some sense, will be powerful. They thought they had a friend in Mussolini back in the late 30s and the early 40s, but Mussolini kind of left them high and dry. Now they've tried to work out a system dealing with the European common market and claiming that the situation finds its fulfillment there. Anything to get around the elementary principle that the kingdom of the Lord was actually established in the days of the Roman kings. The Roman kings were in power when Christ was born, when the church began, and when the gospel was first proclaimed. One last thing, they of course claim that when Jesus receives his millennial kingdom, he'll have to come back to the earth to get it. But Daniel tells us that he went back to the Ancient of Days. That would be the first person of the Godhead. And it was when he went back to heaven that he was given power and dominion and a kingdom. They have him getting the kingdom in the wrong place at the wrong time. Daniel said it would be in heaven at the time of the ascension. In fact, there are only about 10 days between the ascension and the establishment of the church. They have the Lord having to come back to the earth in order to get that kingdom. And yet in the parable of the pounds, he said that he had to go into the far country to get the kingdom. Well, interestingly enough, he gave that parable in Palestine, near Jerusalem, and the far country would not be Jerusalem and Judea. But the major prophets of the Old Testament refute coming and going, the ridiculous, the absurdity, and the perniciousness of premillennialism. A person cannot be a premillennialist and be a Christian. The two systems are just antagonistic to each other. Thanks for your good attention.